three items on the agenda, discussion of fatigue risk management, discussion of the employee safety communications, and a review of, yeah, it's on. Review of incidents. Are there any questions about the agenda?
I think you may need a gavel.
Yes. Could I ask those who are leaving to leave the room and we'll...
Move the approval of the agenda.
Is there a second? All in favor of the agenda?
Aye.
Safety contact, Mr. Doherty?
Chairman Downing, we asked for just a moment to get the presentations. I'll give the contact. I know we want to get the presentation up on the board if we could.
You're going to start with the safety contact?
Yes, sir.
While we're waiting, are there, can I have a motion regarding the minutes? Moved and seconded to accept the minutes of the June meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Back to you.
Thank you. Again, good morning, Chairman Downey, members of the committee. This morning's safety contact is on swimming pool safety. As you've noticed last week, and we'll talk about it a little later, it's hot outside, or has been. And we all want some relief from the sweltering sun, but pool season doesn't come without potential risks. Every day, about 10 people die from unintentional drowning. Of these, two are children aged 14 or younger. Drowning ranks fifth among the leading causes of unintentional injury death in the United States. We have compiled a few safety tips to help you stay safe during the summer. At home pool safety tips. As you may already know, if you have a pool at home, you need a fence that is at least 4 feet high with a self-closing, self-latching gate that has a locking mechanism beyond a child's reach. Keep grates and drain covers in good repair and secured in place. Children are not developmentally ready for swim lessons until after their fourth birthday. Swim programs for children under the age of four should not be seen as a way to decrease the risk of drowning. Make sure you know infant and child CPR if you own a pool. Keep rescue equipment such as a shepherd hook or a long pole with a hook on the end and a life preserver, as well as a telephone, in proximity to the pool. Swimming safety tips. Supervision is a must. Never leave children alone in or near the pool, even for a moment. Always have rescue devices, such as UL-listed life preservers nearby. Flotation devices, toys, and inflatable swimming aids are not safety devices. They are toys and can easily puncture and deflate. Always drain wading pools after children are done playing. Infants can drown in just a few inches of water. Remove all toys when you leave the pool. Toys may attract children to the unattended pool. By following these simple tips, we can all enjoy a safe summer at the pool. Thank you, and have a safe day. And in the event of a building alarm, we would ask that if the alarm sounds, that you exit either through the doors behind me or over behind the cameras. Might be a little bit tough to get through there. And go out the front door and meet across the building at the building museum near the nut and bolts. That concludes the safety presentation for this morning.
We need one of the cameras moved because it's blocking the exit.
We need to have a direct path behind Mayor Yulee there, if we could, gentlemen. You leaving too?
Just take your cameras with you.
That's true. That's somehow we required path would be about 44 inches. So I don't know that we have that, guys. Okay. Good morning again. In addition to our safety statistics, we have a briefing on the progress of our fatigue management program, our safety communications campaign, and updates on recent incidents. First, I'd like to talk about where we're at in the progress of our fatigue risk management system, or our fatigue program, if you will. But in keeping with the committee's request, I'd like to provide an update of our work toward realization of our fatigue risk management system. The concept of a fatigue risk management system is recognized in sleep science literature and by the National Transportation Safety Board, as well as other expert bodies. At the core of WMATA's program will be appropriate restrictions on hours of service for all of our safety-sensitive employees. To provide a little background, hours of service limits are only part of the program. Considering developments in sleep science, NTSB recommendations, data from other modes of transportation, and program experience in aviation and other domains, we have concluded that an integrated and comprehensive approach was warranted. Fatigue is part of our everyday lives, and no employer can completely eliminate fatigue from the workplace. But we can implement measures to prevent and mitigate fatigue, including a strong emphasis on personal responsibility that is enabled by education and training. In order to proceed using a science-based approach, we are initially focusing on safety-critical occupations, emphasizing those jobs that involve the greatest risk to the public and coworkers, as determined through a hazard assessment. Then we will proceed to address the remaining safety-sensitive occupations. You'll remember last November we briefed the committee on the findings of the Joint Rail Tri-State Oversight Committee WMATA Fatigue Management Study. We identified gaps in the authority's programs and policies that caused a minority of our employees to work excess hours and noted missed opportunities to prevent and mitigate fatigue. We have now completed our interviews for our bus fatigue study and initial data analysis for an equivalent metro bus study, and the draft report is being reviewed and edited. Here are some of the highlights. It notes that only 21% of WMATA bus operator assignments are swing or split shift. And that's basically where the operators are on a given amount of time, approximately 4 hours, off 4 hours, back on 4 hours. And that providing quiet rooms in every bus facility may not be possible given the space and other constraints. But we are looking for ways to mitigate potential fatigue in our workforce. I want to stress we do have good news here. This data is for a full, very busy month last summer. And what we did is we took the same time period that conducted their audit in July of 2011, and we're comparing that with July 2011 for our bus group. So what it shows overall is a very sustainable pace of work for most employees. However, there are some long shifts in a few cases where consecutive days worked were more than we desire, given any employee's need to attend to the other necessities of life. So we believe that this indicates a need for clear policies and follow-up to ensure that they are applied consistently. Bus management is already monitoring overtime to head us in the right direction, and a number of bus vacancies have already been filled. So if our study period was for the current month, July 2012, we would see significant improvement. If you note the last bullet, we find a way to model appropriate behaviors if we're going to achieve the most positive safety culture. This is challenging to do while still providing essential transportation services across the region. But recognizing the issue is the first step in addressing it. This slide is from the bus maintenance group and presents a different picture from transportation. And again, there is good news since generally the hours are well regulated and most employees get regular days off. We are concerned that some of the night shift workers may have outside employment that could possibly interfere with getting adequate rest. Night shift work is a difficult area for all of transportation, since our body clocks continue to fight for sleep during the late night and early morning hours. And night shift workers often have difficulty getting sufficient quality sleep during the daylight hours. This is Metro Access. We did include them also in our study. We, at this point in time, we have completed interviews of operators and have obtained work hour data that we're currently reviewing. And when we have the analysis, we will provide an update to the committee on the Metro Access fatigue study. We wanted to talk about some of our interim actions since we reported last year. Our fatigue program is built on the foundation of some positive steps that we have already taken. Sleep disorders like obstructive sleep apnea can interfere with rest and more than double the risk of a mishap. WMATA brought the medical certification process for commercial driver's license holders in-house in 2009. In 2010, the program was extended to rail operators, and in 2011 began the process of extending medical certifications to all safety-sensitive employees. This program has already identified a number of employees with sleep disorders, and most of those employees have shown success in adhering to their treatment regimens. And that may include wearing such things as a CPAP pump or a continued positive air pressure pump. Looking at the fatigue issue in light of the rail report and recognizing that constructing a fatigue management system would take time, earlier this year, management identified three Metro Rail job groups for interim actions. Our automatic train control personnel were put under work hour restrictions to 14 hours maximum on duty, 10 hours off minimum, effective in April of this year. Two other functional groups were put on notice. The new work hour restrictions would be required at the beginning of 2013 for our electric power group and on-track equipment operators within track and structures. I want to emphasize that this is a minimum set of actions subject to supplementation and adjustment as we gain a better science-based understanding of the challenges that we face. Managers in both rail and bus divisions are aware of the fatigue needs in their departments. By staffing up and better managing overtime, they are helping us to move where we need to be. At this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Steve Hirsch. He's working with us. He has developed programs for the Department of Defense, for the Federal Aviation Administration, as well as others, and he's with the Institutes for Behavior Resources, and he's actually going to describe some of our next steps as he's been working with us, getting engaged, so that we can progress with our science-based approach to build a, probably what we believe will be the best program in transit today. Dr. Hirsch.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to give you an update on where we are with developing a fatigue risk management system. The next step is to build integrated structures which within each element we can optimize for to the extent possible. You know, a fatigue risk management system is an organic and active process to proactively minimize fatigue risk in all safety-sensitive and critical personnel. The four building blocks for a mature FRMS are shown on your slide. Over the course of the next year, these building blocks will be developed and implemented. Once constructed, the FRMS will be a living system that constantly monitors fatigue status and adapts to changing conditions to continuously improve performance. The four building blocks are policies and procedures, tools and methods to assess fatigue, training, education, and publicity to support the personal fatigue management of the employees, and organization and personnel to support the system. The details of the four components will be briefly reviewed. Hours of service are definitely a critical part of the policies and procedures that we need to manage fatigue. But it's only one of a range of policies and procedures that we need for a robust fatigue risk management system. So the most effective fatigue risk management system combines hours of service policies with fatigue management tools that actually assess fatigue, performance, and fatigue in employees using fatigue modeling. In addition, we provide policies and procedures and tools for assessing and correcting sleep disorders and providing training for better personal fatigue management and countermeasures in employees, and procedures for reporting fatigue and investigating potential fatigue as part of incidents and accidents. An effective FRMS builds on fatigue measurement. You cannot manage fatigue if you can't assess it or measure it. A valid approach is required to evaluate fatigue that would be expected from the schedules that employees work. The approach that will be used has been validated by the Federal Railroad Administration and offers a continuous window into potential fatigue drivers from scheduling practices, overtime, and other factors that limit opportunities for sleep. The Safety Fast model is the biomathematical model that we will be using, and it has been shown to be the gold standard for assessing fatigue in the rail industry, and has been validated by the Federal Railroad Administration. The model has been shown to be able to predict increased accident risk resulting from schedule-induced fatigue. The third component is training. Fatigue management is a shared responsibility with employees. Given adequate time to be rested, the employee must use that time effectively to be fully rested. Education about personal fatigue management is an essential part of the process. And tools for reporting fatigue is a useful tool for getting a window into those conditions which we are potentially unaware of that employees are experiencing. And that allows us to develop mitigations for those situations. In addition, education about sleep disorders so that our employees can do their part to be fit for duty and to address their disorders. And overall publicity about the FRMS system so that people can utilize the tools and the procedures that are part of that system to better assist us in managing fatigue. The fourth element is organization. The FRMS only functions if it has an organizational home and an active role for certain employees within WMATA. This home within the organization receives information about potential fatigue factors in each employee group and takes ownership of finding effective ways to mitigate those drivers of fatigue. This group engages in a continuous performance improvement process. Mr. Dougherty has convened an executive fatigue steering committee to take ownership at the policy level, and a second-tier group of experts from the various departments will guide the implementation process. As the system reaches a state of relative maturity, a successor organization will be needed to sustain and iteratively modify the system based on experience and fatigue information that's collected along the way. The process that we will be following is a fatigue risk management process that uses five steps. We measure current conditions or conditions as they change, and we analyze those conditions, subjecting them to fatigue modeling, for example, to determine how much fatigue might be expected to occur under those conditions. We submit that information to a management group, and that group then develops mitigations and modifications to practices to minimize, reduce, or eliminate fatigue, or institute additional training to help employees better manage their fatigue. And then following that, we continuously monitor the results of this process to ensure that the changes that we've made have had the expected outcome of reducing fatigue and that we avoid unintended adverse consequences. Any system has to be monitored for effectiveness if it's going to be a continuous performance improvement process. And if at the end of the day we find that there are still pockets of fatigue or conditions that we haven't appropriately mitigated, then we continue this process and find an additional mitigation for that situation. This is not done once and forgotten. This is a continuous process we do repeatedly over the course of time, and we'll have a home for continuous performance improvement within WMATA. Supporting that is data. You can't have a continuous performance improvement if we don't feed it with data. We need to have data about concurrent conditions. We need to have data about the effect of our changes. So data on actual employee sleep patterns will be collected. Both their quantity and quality of sleep in relation to schedules that they work will greatly aid the fatigue estimation process. The results of the data collection will inform policy and training about sleep and fatigue. And data will be collected in two phases over the course of the next several years to provide an assessment of our progress as we implement the system and the various changes that are anticipated.
Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. As you're aware, you know, nothing is free, but we should look forward to making the investments in the fatigue risk management system as the costs are better identified. Some of the benefits are, when we consider the challenges, We should also recognize the theory behind state of good repair applies to our people as well. Effective worker support, quality service, including better reliability and lower costs. Here is a full timeline for the rollout of the fatigue risk management system. December of this year, just a few months away, is the target for delivery of a basic plan, including hours of service restrictions for safety critical employees. In 2013, we will add countermeasures for the other safety sensitive employees, and we will work into May of 2014 with contractor support to ensure that the system is complete and sufficiently mature. That one, we know it is working as intended, and two, we can maintain it with success. And that would complete our update on the fatigue program.
Yeah, earlier in the first of all, thank you for the presentation. It's very thorough, and even though I'd like to see things done quicker, and looking at the timeline, I suppose that's a reasonable timeline that's before us, although certainly accelerating it as best you can would be appreciated. The question I have is, where are we on a status on how we're doing on hiring bus operators? You know, we were in the backlog situation. We added resources to hopefully accelerate the hiring. I think at some point you'll always have some vacancies, so is there a light at the end of the tunnel where we see where we're at that point?
We're in good shape with regard to hiring bus operators. We've gotten the vacancy rate down. I think it's around 3%. I've checked that.
3%, you said?
I think that's about it. You can check that. But basically, Jack Reef was saying, I'm good. You know, we were just...
I'll say it. Go ahead, say it, Jack.
Just good?
Better than good. We have about 2,500 bus operators. Currently, we have 49 vacancies. We have 20 people in training. When they come out July 20th, we'll have 29 vacancies out of 2,500. And that's, you know, we have people off for different reasons. They could come back. So we're kind of at the edge as to where we're prepared to funnel people to rail if we need to, but we have an adequate workforce to provide the services that we do.
All right. Thank you.
I want to say that I appreciate the need for good science about making decisions, in part because what this authority does will have a significant impact on the rest of the transit industry nationwide. I think that we have a responsibility to proceed with all due speed and due diligence in that process, though. I'm concerned about whether or not this time frame allows the authority to make a decision about weekly caps on hours of work. Every other transportation mode in America, freight engineers, truckers, intercity bus, commuter rail, maritime, everybody has not only a daily limit on hours of service, but a cumulative fatigue cap on hours of work in safety-sensitive positions. It shouldn't be rocket science work to get to the same conclusion about safety-critical bus and rail positions for the authority. I think it's good that we have started with rail safety and have agreements about 1410, but 14 hours of work per day for 7 days a week is 98 hours of work per week that would be authorized within that framework. I think it was significant that the head of 689 said publicly, this hours of service thing is a management choice. Management assigns the work. Management has control of this. That was as public a statement as I've seen anybody make about our responsibilities about control of overtime as a safety issue. I hope that we can come to some agreement about when we would get to a recommendation about a cap on hours of work per week as a safety framework.
The time frame that we're aiming at, and we've been aiming for some time, is by December on the safety critical positions to come to that conclusion. And in the meantime, I will say that with the hiring of additional folks, not only bus operators, but we had committed to the board previously that to support the hours of work restriction in a couple areas that were listed on the board before, we focused on hiring people there, and we've been doing that, and we're very close to meeting the target in the time frame that we said we would to help relieve that, those kind of issues.
I think it would be helpful in the discussion to be sure we always distinguish between safety critical and safety sensitive. The goal is to get to all of them. Safety critical is a much smaller subset, and major issues ahead. Jim?
Yeah, a couple of points. One, just to pick up on what's been said earlier, I, too, am concerned about the time frame. I think we can move this along a little – hopefully we can move it along a little faster. But I also think it's interesting Tom's reference to the public statement indicating that it's in our hands. To me, that's even more incentive for us to step it up and do it as quickly as we can. If it's been acknowledged that, okay, the ball is in your court, then I think we ought to be moving as aggressively as we can. And related to that, has the union leadership been involved in the developing of this study, and are they having input into this thing? Because ultimately, they're going to have a key role to play in this. And as you know, with the ongoing discussions, I think it's very timely.
Yeah, there's been some contact made with Ms. Jeter and the union, but also they are involved. It will be involved in the study. They've been invited to participate with us, so they're, you know, we're extending the opportunity.
Well, they've been invited. Have they responded? Are they engaged? Are they, since they've seemed to indicate that they've got some ideas, and once again, picking up on that quote, I think there was some reference in there that we know that there's some things that can be done to address this, so I would think that that be incumbent upon them to be actively engaged and put something on the table if they've got some ideas. Well, I just make sure it's clear on the record that we've extended that offer and that they need to be a part of it, and that if purely from a safety point of view, this board needs to move as aggressively as it can and take steps which will address safety not only for our workers but for our customers. So,
and I believe the union leadership is also equally interested in the safety of our workers. So I think ultimately there will be good cooperation on this.
Good. Okay.
Thanks for the presentation. I would like to suggest or recommend that we get the board get an overlay of the new transit safety provisions in the legislation the president signed last Friday afternoon. And there's starts with a big first time ever transit safety requirement, which got watered down from what the administration wanted. But there's a handful of other transit safety provisions in the new legislation, and that have to over, I would like to see how that overlays on what we're trying to do, or if it doesn't matter, just let us know. And realizing that there's a fuse on when the DOT has or FTA has to issue a rulemaking or a policy statement or what, but there's a bunch of them in the bill.
We'll give you a report on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I continue to be troubled by the amount of time our employees are on the job. I think this is a critical safety issue, and I note that Mr. Doherty indicated we've put a limit for personnel involved in automatic train control of 14 hours. Do we really want to be riding on trains? You know, somebody's been working for 13 hours and they're in charge of automatic train control, or the person operating the train has been working 12, 13, 14 hours. I don't think so. And so I would ask Dr. Hirsch, am I just off base here? Am aren't people, haven't they lost their ability to do the job well after 10, 11, 12, 13 hours? Am I wrong?
Well, it really depends a lot on the time of day. I mean, if you, you know, and how often they're having to do that. So, it's the point of trying to do this in a science-based way is to develop nuanced rules that allow us to manage fatigue while at the same time maintain efficient operations. But I agree with you. We need to look at those limits, and we are going to find, we're going to get all of the data from schedules. We're going to look at them in detail, looking to see to which kinds of patterns of work are creating the greatest fatigue, and put in limitations to avoid that. There may be occasions when 14 hours of work is perfectly safe. The Federal Aviation Administration allows air crew to operate for 14 hours during the daytime, but they have limitations on how long they can work at night. So I think I'd like us to be creative about thinking about developing rules here and policies which are not already 10 years old when we put them in place. And the FAA has generated some pretty creative ways of monitoring and assessing and managing fatigue to take into account the body clock. And I would like to see rules here that consider the body clock. We may not want to have the same rule for night jobs as we have for day jobs. So I'm concerned about putting something in place that we hurry into and then discover that 6 months later, when we really look at the science, that we should have done it a little differently.
That goes to a portion. You noted, Mr. Dowdy, that the Metro Access Fatigue Study includes, it's going on. You're starting with the data collection there.
Yes, ma'am.
And I think my question is regarding, again, as Mr. Hirsch says, it's what you're doing and when you're doing it that determines the level of where fatigue plays at risk for our employees and our customers. And in our contract, we have set a number of hours. How do we roll that into this to make sure that, one, we're thinking about the job that's being done there, as well as the contract that we are going out to in the future to ensure that this entire piece is going to be included?
And that's a balance that we certainly have to, you know, have. And we've talked with the CEO of our contractor, and he has actually implemented, some work rules that have been put in place, and I know that he's been very concerned also that he is in step with us and, you know, for our current contract that we want to move forward, and that's why we have included them as a part of this, and they have stated that they basically are willing to comply with what we put together as far as our findings for their hours of service and in fatigue management, and have indicated they want to be in lockstep with us.
Briefly, I just want to associate myself with Mike's comments. I totally agree with you about the cap and everything else, but it also ties back into my previous question, because what hasn't been said yet is the reality is that your hands are tied to some extent by the rules that are in place now that have been in place that give priorities to certain folks to working hours and things of that nature. And that's why I think it's absolutely critical that the union be at the table with us, because quite honestly, our hands are tied because of some of these agreements. And if we're going to make any changes, we need to be aggressive about that. And so I just wanted to reiterate that point. So be sure to invite them again, okay?
Point well taken, sir, and we will.
Build on Mr. Dyke's comment. I think it'd be useful to look at the extent to which our hands actually are tied. If there's a safety issue involved, I don't think we bargain. Every mode that I've worked in, there's a minimum level with respect to hours of service. Oftentimes, there'll be a bargaining level that would provide greater time off, but I've never seen a bargaining level that allows you to go above the safety limited hours of service.
Mr. Downey, thank you, and thanks for the presentation. And we may have gotten this information in an earlier presentation, but is there a category of workers at Metro who were most concerned about fatigue with?
Safety critical applications that we previously. We can give you another report on the safety critical.
And when, and they include what?
APC, there's power operators, equipment operators, I think it's train and...
Electric power, yeah, train operators.
Okay, so what you've included in this report is the study on bus operators. Has there been a similar study, I think you looked at July 2011, of 1 month in any of the other categories? Okay. And finally, the point about accelerated hiring. What, and I know you've made some organizational changes with regard to how HR reports to you. Have there been any other concrete things done to demonstrate how we're going to be more aggressive about hiring?
Well, we've actually stepped up our recruiting efforts in the way we do that, the way we handle our medical checkups and background checks. And, in fact, what we've seen is steady improvement in the reduction in the vacancy rate. We're down to about 5.3% now. I think last month we were at 6.5% or 6.7%. We hired, filled over 200 positions, mostly in the areas that we've been talking about to support fatigue management, to support the state of good repair efforts, and I'd be glad, and I think we'd be giving the board an update on that. We do that quarterly, so we've made progress. Now, I will also say that come July 1st, there's been a lot more positions added in the budget, so the vacancy rate will jump up again. But we also knew we were going to work that way our way down. What we have seen is significant improvement in our hiring ability, and if you look at numbers year over year, we're far ahead of what we did last year. We're very close, but haven't gotten there, very close to what we said we would do this year, and I want to see that snowball in hell. And dedicated hiring. So, yes, we've made a number of changes.
Any other questions? I just had two quick questions or requests. I'd like to get the numbers in terms of the categories of work that are safety critical mm-hmm. and safety sensitive, so we really understand the, sure. the magnitude, sort of craft by craft, mm-hmm. what are they? And then secondly, as you're defining the longer term effort for the fatigue management system, and I agree we should be doing this and it should be science based, I'd like to know within that, what is the management information system and what is the information that would filter up to us so that we can see that we're getting there. You know, we don't have to be at every desk every day, but we really need to know in aggregate how can we be assured that this is being successful, because I think with respect to fatigue management, respect to lots of other issues, this board's policy is safety comes first, second, and third. We've got to have that assurance, and it can't be traded off for anything else.
I think our two KPIs on employee and customer injuries.
Yeah, I was kind of curious. It does show an increase in both the employee injury rate and the customer injury rate, but the question on the employee injury rate, is it broken down by shop or area of work? In other words, is there a trend? Is there more in one area than the other? And I'm just kind of curious. This just gives me a raw total number.
Okay. Basically, you know, as far as the jump that we're seeing this month, is we had one case where we had one group of our employees that were struck by an intoxicated driver, and that sent four employees to the hospital. And they were treated and released. We've had an increase there. However, that's certainly not within their, you know, their responsibility for that. We've had some police officers that were more aggressive in arrests that have been injured as a result of those arrests. And that there actually includes eight of those injuries for the month. I can tell you that June, we aren't now tracking back down. We also noticed that as we come into this season that we have more employees claiming injuries, where we've created an employee injury review committee from with various departments, and we're going to look into that, you know, in a more detail. We have the greatest number still are our slips, trips, and falls. We have added a what we call body mechanics class so that employees are taught how to properly lift and not injured in lifting, and also continually work to make sure that any slippery surfaces are cleaned, and that you also need to, you know, maintain vigilance whenever you're walking, whenever you're moving, that we're not looking at Blackberries or PDAs, anything along that line. So we are working definitely diligently to address those, you know, the increase. But we did see, you know, basically injuries that would do just one accident amongst our employees, as well as we've had some bus accidents that we've been struck by others. When we get into the customer injuries, someone ran a red light and struck us, and we end up with those injuries also. But we're definitely aggressively working to reduce that. We do see a reduction again now, backtracking for June, but we're going to continue to delve deeper. And your answer, yeah, we do have it by district.
Shorter answer on the next question, please. On customer injury rates, are they more on rail and then bus? And is there a correlation between the increase on some of the stations, like in Tacoma, where I get on, where it's basically a construction zone, partial construction zone, the restricted walking? Is there any correlation to those injury rates to those kinds of things we're doing on our platforms?
Well, actually, the rail injuries do account for a majority of those, and they're basically escalator injuries in what we call our rail transit facilities, such as the platforms that you mentioned, and in the parking areas. And so we're, as you know, we're doing announcements, things along that line, as well as Ms. Bowersox will talk shortly on what we're doing with our employee and customer safety campaigns. Correct, sir.
Yes.
Do you want to?
Okay. Good morning. I want to briefly introduce Zena McGowan-Thomas, our employee communications manager, who's been the project manager on this effort. She'll be distributing some materials. As you know, we have this year a 5% target to reduce both employee and customer injuries. In looking at this area with safety and with the line management organizations and with the general manager, we identified that the majority of employee injuries, and that has been the first phase of our focus, really do come from the very basic, and this is industry-wide, it's pretty consistent, slips, trips, and falls. Safety asked us, in terms of communications out to the mass number of employees that we have, to look at a couple of areas. One was personal protective equipment and trying to encourage the wearing of PPE. We did some survey work that told us that PPE isn't always consistently being worn because of comfort and convenience issues. And what people don't say is that sometimes there's a bit of a style issue associated with some of the equipment. We also looked at slips, trips, and falls in terms of general awareness. And when we looked at the rest of the industry to sort of see what others were doing, knowing that this was an industry-wide problem, we found a lot of campaigns that read like do's and don't lists, regulations, rules, what to do, what not to do. And the tone of most of those at other transit properties came across to us as a little bit of scolding. We weren't sure that was the best approach with our employees. So instead, we set about to create communications that would inspire people, that would motivate them, and that would tug a little bit at their emotions. And maybe in that way, and through using some informal tools and tactics, get to people and have them start thinking about safety in a different light than the usual do's and don'ts lists. The first thing that we started out to do, and Chairman Downey knows that he participated in our celebration of the champions, safety champions that we have here at Metro, is to celebrate those employees who are doing the right thing all the time. And we do have an annual recognition program for them. They are incredibly inspiring individuals, some of whom have driven buses 1 million, 2 million, 3 million miles without incident, some of whom have worked countless rail shutdowns without incident. And the voices of those employees were, to me, the place to begin, because they are the role models. They set the standard. I have a little clip from the video that we showed at that ceremony. We asked those employees who were being recognized to talk a little bit to their peers about why safety is important from their point of view.
When I first came to Metro, I saw Metro operators walking around with these patches. And I used to ask them, you know, what is this? Well, it's a safe driving award patch. And it was different colors. And one of them had a gold one on. It was 5 years. He said, well, after 5 years, you get a gold patch. And so I said to myself, oh, one day I'm going to get me one of those patches too.
And as a result of that incident, it really made me understand that following the procedures, doing it by the book, is the best way to operate. Safety is number one, and if you take a shortcut, it will come back to bite you sooner or later.
We are not a set of rules. We are the philosophy that says that safety is an ongoing education.
My personal goal that I tell my guys all the time is, you know, you need to go home. You need to leave Metro in the same condition or better than what you arrived when you started the shift.
We can't come to Metro doing as we please, when we please. There are obligations that we have to follow and rules and regulations we have to follow.
Patience. Number one, patience. Know what you're supposed to do. Do what you're supposed to do. And be observant of your surroundings at all times. You know, if you do those things, you're pretty much on the right track.
And so the full video from that presentation was placed on the intranet at Metro so that all Metro employees could watch and be inspired by their peers. And we also took the champions of safety and put them on a Metro calendar. I know many of the board members have a calendar. Hopefully you're displaying it in your office wall. But we hadn't had a Metro calendar before. And so literally making safety heroes our poster children, as it were, and celebrating their success was important to us. And people who have been featured here and who are featured in the video have gotten a lot of positive feedback of that recognition from their peers. In the second wave of our outreach, we wanted to create some posters and some communications that would speak to employees about protective equipment, as I mentioned earlier. And the way that we decided to approach that was to say, people that you admire wear PPE. It's not inconvenient. It's not unstylish. It's necessary. And so these posters went up in facilities. They're on bulletin boards. They're in break rooms. They're even on bathroom walls, any place where we had an opportunity to stop people and get them to think about safety. And I will tell you that it's hard to measure sometimes success of these kinds of communications, but the one measure that I do have is that as these got seen around the facilities in the field, Zena's phone rang off the hook, and we got emails saying, we want more of these. Where did you come up with these? People really like them. They're the buzz of the break room. So we think that it resonated with our employees. Go to the next one. In addition to communications in a sort of formal context, we tried to reach out to people in a different way. We distributed quizzes, and I think you've gotten, or Zena will give you copies of these quizzes. The quizzes, in fact, we used word find quizzes, crossword puzzles, all kinds of things to get people to, you know, engage in something that would talk about goggles and flammable objects and work boots and personal protective equipment. We gave out small prizes for winners. We had more than 2,000 employees take the quizzes. And in fact, we only planned to do 3. In the end, we did 4 because they were so popular, people requested that we do another one. So we knew that people were talking about these, and we had another opportunity to talk about safety when we went out to give the prizes out at local safety committees in the field. So each of these little devices really did give us an opportunity to get people focused on safety. On the next slide, just want to mention that our efforts are very much a companion piece to what's being done in the line operations. Safety is very much a line operation responsibility here. Rail and bus are undertaking local safety committee meetings. They are issuing safety tips. They have safety stand-downs. Jim's organization provides lessons learned for them. And so as we look at, as was mentioned earlier, pockets of concern when injuries do go up, we're able to participate and tag team with them and provide additional support and information so that any specific areas of employee injury or concern can be addressed. But I think one of the most powerful things is to have those rail and bus employees who have exemplary safety records mentor other employee peers and speak on those occasions when things need addressed, because they're a much more powerful messenger than we are.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question? Not so much a question, but a suggestion. And I don't want to sound like a beaten, broken record here, but a video of those individuals who spoke about their commitment to safety and how important they thought it was, I think would be good starting points for you to reach out and ask them what their thoughts are as you put together this study on fatigue and safety and what have you, because clearly they've got the message and they know how important it is, and they've demonstrated a commitment to that. So just a thought.
Thank you. The next wave of communications that's being distributed this summer is what we call the emotional appeal. So in most of the other transit properties, we saw the organization saying, you know, Metro or Metra or this railroad wants you to be safe. And it didn't strike us that that was probably enough. Who wants you to be safe is really important, and your family wants you to be safe. Your family needs you to be safe. And so trying to link people back to other motives for why they need to come home uninjured was our goal here. So this set of ads really is focused on those events in life that nobody wants to miss. Giving away the bride, your daughter, at her wedding, family reunion, summer picnic. On the next slide, we have teaching your son to shave. A small moment, but an important one in the life of a family. Watching your child get his high school diploma. Again, a really important moment. And I have to say that, again, this has really resonated. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback. We're getting requests to distribute more of these in more places in the field. So this kind of message also says to people, we really care about our employees, and we really want you to be safe, and your families care about you too. This is also a setup for each year we have rail and bus fairs, safety fairs, as part of the rodeos, safety rodeos, and this gives us an opportunity to involve families. And so what we're doing is providing interactive opportunities for the children to come in and participate. So if you've ever been to the shore in the summertime where they have the camera booth, and you go in and maybe you get dressed up and you have your picture taken like in an old Western outfit, well, our family's children will come in and they'll dress like mom and dad in the hard hat with the goggles and have the safety equipment and get their pictures taken so that they can look like mom and dad doing safe things at work. General managers also asked us to look for electronic games for kids that feature safety because the e-games are so popular. So we found electronic games for adults, funny enough, but we're still working on identifying some for children.
When we worked on the campaign to get people to use their seat belts, the biggest weapon we had was the kids. Kids should say, did you wear your equipment today?
That's an excellent point, because that generation really changed the way we thought about seatbelts and safety. I'm sure that, and that's a very good point. We need to make sure that we give the kids something that helps them remember to talk to mom and dad.
I think the doing, whether it's an electronic, I'm not sure always it's electronic, but the earlier the better, And there are lots of things we can do, such as booklets, coloring booklets, or puzzles for kids and things of that nature, because they walk away and they get engaged very early on, and they start to emulate exactly that.
Lynn and I have had some fun on that. She was with the coloring books. I said, my grandchildren are young, and they're all in the band, you know, these little things going like crazy. We got to get with it.
We're gonna do both coloring sticker books for the younger children and hopefully an electronic game for the older. The last wave in the employee campaign this year will be a focus on personal responsibility, as was mentioned by Dr. Hirsch and by Jim Doherty. You know, really, at the end of the day, we can have all the right messages, we can have all the proper training, but people have to decide to make good safety choices. And so Be Somebody Else is really a positive message that says, don't wait for the next guy. Don't see a safety hazard and say, well, somebody else will come along and do that. You be that person. You be the change. So that'll be the next phase, and there's a number of other tactics that are in your presentation that go with that. The one thing that I didn't mention was this deck of cards. And it doesn't seem like a very big item, but this deck of cards has been very popular. It actually is a deck of cards prepared very cheaply that reminds people to check on their safety information at our intranet site. What we found when we talked to employees was that one of the most popular things to do in our break rooms when people are between is they sit and play cards. So rather than to just have any cards, we wanted them to think safety. This actually creates conversation. It was a cheap and easy thing to do. So, again, we're really trying to learn from our employees what's going to work with them and trying to respond accordingly. Ultimately, in terms of results, I would note the first 3 months of the year, employee injuries, particularly around slips, trips, and falls, did decline. We did have the uptick that Jim mentioned in April and May. The numbers are better in June. But the areas where we even saw the uptick were not around these areas. So we hope that employees are starting to focus and think more about this in a positive way. Our next challenge will be to create a campaign for our customers. Obviously, we have a lot of information that needs to be communicated, and we're trying to find creative ways to engage customers who are bombarded by information every day. We've already heard from some of our board members about the interest in having some communications around some of our emergency protocols so that customers know what to expect in an emergency or in a service disruption. That's certainly going to be part of our thinking there, and I am open for your suggestion and questions. Thank you.
And part of this is also different approaches, so that it's not hearing the same thing over and over and over. It's fresh approaches. Keep it on everybody's front of their brain. Ms. Porter?
I just want to follow up on the last comment you made, because I think that's extremely important about giving dealing with customer issues in emergency situations. I mean, we've had, within the last few months, a couple of instances where people made poor choices in emergency situations. And I think that what we need to do is the same kind of thing that you did here, not to just give people information, but also to look at why it is that people are doing what they're doing. Are we giving people communications that's useful to them? Are we not dealing with situations that are bothering people in some way that we don't understand? I think we really need to get below the surface on some of these issues and look at why people are doing the kinds of things they're doing, passengers are doing the kinds of things they're doing, and go beyond educating them, but look at some of the motivations and deal with some of those issues.
I take that point, and we're going to be having some focus groups with customers in August to try to learn more about the psychology behind some of that behavior and to also test some ideas. Because ultimately, when we go out, we have to make sure that whatever, you know, we think we're communicating is actually what's being heard. So we're going to be following up on your idea.
I think those are excellent ideas. There's probably also some work that we can do on some of the past incidents that have happened recently, because there have been at least one instance that I know of where an individual involved in the train depowering incident actually wrote in and signed their name to a letter. And there are probably other people we can find who can give us useful information.
We should be calling back to them. And also, I know from the chair that the Riders Advisory Council has an interest in being heard on this matter. And so we will also follow up with them.
Mr. Downs.
I'm pleased that there's a comprehensive program to tackle employee injuries. I'm a little puzzled by not having a equal emphasis about the employee's responsibility for the safety of our customers. Over a million customers a day get on the system, and they trust us to not do any bodily injury to them. And they put their fate in the hands of our operations people every single day. It's a matter of trust. We need to, I think, more visibly acknowledge that there is a contract of trust between our operating personnel and our customers about customer safety, and that there are responsibilities and obligations that come that are equal to protecting themselves and each other as employees. We have an obligation to not go too quickly past our employees' responsibility for the stewardship of our customers. Every board meeting, it seems, we have an employee who has gone to an extraordinary extent to protect people in the course of their duty, and we celebrate that. We ought to be able to find ways in this process, in parallel, to celebrate and set as legitimate objectives employees taking care of our customers.
Any other questions for Ms. Barsox?
I'll just say, Mr. Downey, that I'm very pleased with the artwork that you presented, and I can see why you're getting the responses that you're getting. And if the other communications that are going to go out to the writing public are as good, I think that it will go a long way in focusing people on public safety, on the safety in general. Generally, people don't think about safety at all until somebody gets hurt or there is an emergency. So it's always a struggle to kind of get a message that will make people think about it. And I think to my colleague, Mr. Downs's point, that this is the exact right place to start, because sometimes when you have people think about the greater public good, they can't make the calculus of how it affects them. So I think you're in exactly the right place.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to note Ms. Bowersox and Mr. Downs' comments in terms of, I think, the fact that our Riders Advisory Council has spoken up so clearly about this, and that gives us a place to join and partner, and I think it probably will allow the opportunity to provide a lot of feedback, not only from the riding public, but in general, in helping shape what our communications will be in this, because I think this really highlights the connection, almost what we talked about earlier today. I mean, we have to put a picture in folks' mind when we're conveying any of these messages, and that this is a very good way to do it, as you've done here on the safety issue, and the emergency piece is one that I think we can build upon. And I think it really is a good partnership that we can have with the Riders Advisory.
We will follow up with them. Thank you.
Do you have any other comments? I guess the balance of our time, as usual, is to look at some incidents that have occurred and what we've learned and what we will be doing to prevent such occurrences in the future.
Good morning. I've got four different presentations here to go through this morning. I will try to be as quick as possible. Of the four, two of them have a couple of other incidents that we'll be referencing, talking to as well. This is based off the feedback of what we've received. I'd like to start again with the West Hyattsville, and I'd also like to clarify the data that we're talking about here today is preliminary information. You know, again, we have turned this around in a very short time frame. There still needs to be more reviews and stuff that need to be conducted, interviews of employees and everything else to make sure that we didn't miss anything. But at the same point in time, I want to take the opportunity to discuss some of the measures that we've already placed, that we've undertaken. And Mr. Nichols had noted on some items about investment and risk and everything else, and we want to kind of footnote that in there as well. So if we could go to the next slide. Right here at the time frame at 4:41 is whenever we had the, you know, at least the third rail power that was noted down. We went through the notification on this process here, as you can see. Within 7 minutes, we had the Bladensburg Fire Department and our transit police and stuff, you know, were responding at that time frame. Basically, at 5:12, you know, again, to develop a plan, whenever we were in this situation, it was a matter of halt service in place, and it's about taking care of the customers and getting them evacuated as quickly and as safely as possible. Here gives you an overall effort. Note the 7:44 time, because realistically we view that as kind of like a stand down time. Towards it's all about taking care of the scene, taking care of the customers, making sure that even after the event and stuff is clear, that all of the transit police, safety staff, fire department, everybody is clear of the area, because whenever we go back into this area, it's like a whole nother development of people and resources and repairing of the system and stuff. So it's not only how we got into this issue, but it's also very important on how we manage ourselves and our staff coming out of these things. We did restore both tracks to revenue service for, you know, for the morning. Sunday night, we did open up the one of the tracks, you know, a little bit early. If we go to the next slide. This isn't a shot. This is the train, the back end of the train. It shows that it's re-railed. Whenever it did come off the track, it was basically up against the wall. You can see where this thing was moved down a little bit, but you can see some damage and stuff where everything was ripped off and such on here. This slide here, I'd like to spend a little bit of time to talk about this. What we have here is, as you can see, the deformation of the rail. This is what we call ballast, where you see the rocks and everything else. So this is very critical on some of our discussions that we have here. This is a ballasted area. Where you see this brown, this is concrete. We call that direct fixation. Basically, what you had is you had a transition point where and I've got a diagram where you're basically going through a ballasted area, coming down into an area where it's called direct fixation, and it holds it in place. I'd also like to kind of note here off to the side, this is a third rail. This is where we collect energy to power the cars. And if you notice that whenever this did occur and stuff, these stands that actually support this third rail, there was enough energy that basically shifted everything right away from where it's intended alignment. Next slide, please. Okay, this is an overall diagram. I know it's a little bit busy. We cut a lot of stuff out of it here, but basically what we have here is the blue area represents the area of the damaged track, pretty much the overall side, about 1,300 feet. We know the rail car was going at, above 50 miles an hour. The operator did see this. I mean, there was a deformation in what you saw in the previous slides. That's kind of like an after effect. We know that if an after effect, if the train would have approached something like that, we would have derailed every rail car on that. The red right in here represents the back three trains of that consist that were confirmed that were, you know, derailed. And then the green were part of the consist, which represents basically the trains that remained on the ball of rail. This area right in here, from an evacuation standpoint, we had a vent shaft and stuff, and so that was primarily the focus of activity whenever we were in the process of recovering and making sure that everybody was evacuated. Whenever we started doing all of our work and stuff, naturally it started all the way back in here where you saw the previous picture. I want to point this out here. This line right in here is an actual track chart that kind of shows us a gradient of where we were coming from PG Plaza down to West Hyattsville. So if you could just imagine, we are not level. This is not straight track. It's basically about 4 degrees pitch on where we're going down. Then you have super elevation where this thing is turning, kind of like a corkscrew to kind of visualize it. And pretty much what we had, a six-car train is probably about 500,000 pounds of metal, and you're traveling over 50 miles an hour carrying customers going into this area of specialized track work. And that's kind of the scenario, this is the area, and this is the actual environment of what we were seeing that was taking place there. Okay, next slide, please. You know, probable cause, again, our feeling is it's definitely, you know, related to heat. Maintenance history of this thing that was taking place, we did have a confirmed, you know, last walking inspection through that area, which we do, you know, twice a week. Did happen, you know, on Thursday. And during this time frame, whenever we were having this severe heat that was out there, basically we did have heat inspectors and stuff. There were extra staff that was riding throughout all of the system, not just the green line, but all the alignments and stuff, you know, working through there. Also, I'd like to note, at the time of this incident, one of the things that also that come out of this is that on the green line itself, we had a green line train that went into a braking activity at Mount Vernon, basically where we do turnbacks. We also had a brake fault that was at Fort Totten. On the other end of the line around Naylor Road and such, we had another report of a heat kink. Whenever all of this stuff started taking place, we had a lot of activity on the railroad just on that green line alone. And we're definitely going to be reviewing that as we go further into this investigation. But there was a lot of activity just all at the same time. And for those who have been to their control center and stuff, you know, there's a lot of radio communications. There's a lot of people and stuff that are out there that's working on this. And we'll definitely be reviewing that more. Next slide, please. One of the things we did want to kind of point out, and to bring this up here, the capital investments that we've been spending our money on, that y'all have been helping us to fund with the one we call about flash butt welding, and pretty much that's where we're welding rail in place. We have been starting this process of de-stressing, you know, when we're installing new rail into this, you know, before this accident. What we see, if you see here, the old standard is pretty much is what they call a preferred laying temperature. It's kind of like whenever you install it. And the easiest way to kind of describe it, hopefully, is that this rail, whenever it's exposed to heat, it expands, just like any other metal or whatever. Then whenever it cools back down, it starts contracting. So a lot of times people, we focus on the laying temperature during the daytime because that's when everybody is, you know, very excited about that because, oh, it's really hot. But on our part, we really have to look at it from an all phases perspective, because whenever you started getting up at 100 degrees or so at night and then all of a sudden you're not cooling back down, what you're having is that your rail continues to expand. Is it really going back to its place of center? Now, you know, this is not just a WMATA issue, by the way. I mean, this is addressed, you know, throughout railroads. The East Coast has been raising stuff. I mean, from where I come from Texas, we use even a much higher temperature than that because we see a lot of expansion, because you'll see 100-plus degrees after midnight. And so this has to be an exact science. This is an exact engineering. This is physics. This is something that where we just – it's just not an approach just to say, oh, it's just straight regular track and it just works this way. This has to be pinpoint accuracy as we undertake this. So with this new standard that we've already started applying, where we're looking at a higher temperature and stuff, that means that all the investments, all of our philosophy, we've already started that back in June of 2011. It's not as a result of this. It's something that's looking ahead. The other component that I'd also kind of lay out is with the track geometry vehicle that we recently gotten here. We cannot stress the importance of that piece of equipment. The ability to start establishing profiles of this railroad in a yearly cycle, not only during the summer, but also during the winter, to see how it moves and how it reacts with the investment, especially since we don't operate two-car trains and four-car trains anymore. You know, we are almost 900 rail cars a day across the system running. So it is definitely, the investment is extremely important. Okay, next slide. Okay, basically what we're looking at in here is, again, the heat rides continually must take place. Speed restrictions, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. as we look at these severe temperatures and such, you know, what we knew, basically we did not have a speed restriction and stuff in place. With this, looking at these standards and stuff, we will have something here developed, some type of baseline, probably by tomorrow. And I'm going to approach it the same way with our engineering and maintenance, kind of like what we did with when we have icy rail conditions, when we have a lot of, you know, leaves or bad weather and everything else. So we're probably going to look at, you know, a range of probably about 30 to 45 miles an hour whenever we go into this activity where we would slow down the railroad. Now, I will say that, you know, heat kinks, this type of stuff could happen even if we're running slower. But what we are trying to establish here is a baseline philosophy of what we need to do going forward. And over time, as we get more information, more data, especially whenever we go into our customer communications report, you're going to see where the work on the railroad is definitely changing, where we're going from guarded number eights to track work and a lot of fastener work there. The other thing is to reassess the existing standards. On the picture where we showed the ballast area where the concrete, one of the things we're also going to look at is that much energy that's being displaced right there. Do the shoulders need to come back a little bit farther to be able to handle the curvature and the force and such that's being applied? And with us having the amount of aerials, the amount of direct fixation, the amount of ballasted areas, those are the areas that we really will monitor. That will dictate what we really need to, because those are the most vulnerable areas of the railroad. Whenever we have straight tangent track, for the most part, not that it's not vulnerable, but it's these areas where you're going from different pitch, different elevation, different grade. That's where we have to establish this. Remote monitoring, something that the engineering group has put out. You know, they do it on bridges. So we're going to start looking at that. Maybe we do that at some type of testing and stuff on some vulnerable areas of our railroad. And then the other component of this is just, you know, the continuous process for improvement. And this is really ties into the same thing of what we've talked about here today, and especially whenever we talk about College Park, is making sure that we respond in a necessary order. It's not just about the scene. It's not just about the exact location. It's about the entire network, and it's also about the layers of amenities that we have around us. So that completes my presentation at this time.
I'd be interested in where we have this geometry problem beyond the derailment from Friday night. Were you talking 50 mile an hour going in a bank? How many other places in the system do we have that kind of configuration, the geometry?
You have it in a lot of locations throughout.
Is that bad engineering from the start?
No, I don't think it's bad engineering. I think that at the time when the system was built, they built it to the best of their ability with the best amenities and best resources. I kind of view it kind of like what with the Class I railroads. Mm-hmm. You know, Class I railroads stayed with the same standard gauge, and they just kept on using it. But what happened? They started putting on bigger locomotives. They started putting on bigger loads and everything else. And we could be at that transitional phase towards we have to look at these things a little bit different because we are a much larger railroad, and we're asking a lot of the system.
Would it make sense, Babe, to re-engineer that pitch grade in the future, or is where you live with it?
I would say, for example, like in this area here, yeah. I think as we will do the review, do the engineering, look at this, maybe there's a way that we can kind of carry back, yeah, you know, the support and stuff in the ballasted area a little bit. But, you know, as far as its rotation and its radiant, what it's doing, I mean, we have that throughout. And I would also say it's not just unique here. It's going to be, you know, throughout transit systems in the U.S. and throughout the world. So, but we definitely need to be much more attentive to the duty cycle of this two-track system that we're putting this much equipment through.
Well, I think you got to get you said you were going to do remote monitoring. My question then would be, where we've had that configuration, that geometrics, that's where I would hope you're going to get monitoring going faster.
Aerial structures.
Most likely.
Yes.
And then the last question I had, Mort, was I'm glad to see what we got took possession of this new technology from the company from Virginia. From the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth. And I read where it's going through its shakedown cruise and so forth. Is there any way to expedite the shakedown cruise to get this new piece of equipment on the railroad?
I am pushing on our staff every day. You know, we want this thing to be out there, and we got the right staff, and we've got the people here, and I suspect it'll be out there a little bit sooner than what we think. Yes, it's a top priority.
I mean, that is a great piece of technology. I think it'll do a lot for us. I didn't realize it's going to do both geometry and track.
Yes.
What the Sperry cars now do.
Yes, sir. It's definitely one of the most advanced pieces of equipment that they, as they noted in their article. We really pushed the envelope on this. And, again, it's the appreciation to the board. It's been a long time coming. It's something that this system needed several years ago. But now we have it, and it's going to be very powerful.
Yeah, just a quick question. Does the quality of steel come into play at all, and the length of time it's been installed? I mean, are these some of the oldest parts of the system, and maybe the issue of a deterioration of the quality of the steel or something like related to that?
Based off of our initial reviews, again, this is preliminary, so I don't want to have an absolute on everything. But what we're seeing at this stage right in here, you know, didn't have like any defects of rail or anything else that was out there, and was there a quality issue? We kind of know the date of when it was, you know, when it was built and everything else, but, you know, it was within tolerance, you know, what we expect.
Mr. Downs, comment?
I wanted to make a comment that from my experience about operating railroad, heat kinks are not an unusual occurrence. It's something that the system has to look at its vulnerabilities, as you've said, figure out ways when temperature gets to a certain point, what kind of monitoring, what kind of precautions you take in that process, and I think you're well on the way to doing that. The comment about continuous process improvement, about customer communications, is a pen gloss for we have to do a whole lot better about what we expect of operating personnel in conditions like this for our customers. Probably it's acceptable to say that this was an unacceptable interaction between operating personnel and customers in terms of what was happening. And I think it needs a...
I think there's a we're confusing two incidents here. I think
I know, but this
in this particular incident, I think it was good communication, and we got kudos from the passengers back. Not the same story in the next one coming up. We needed a lot.
Yeah. Continuous process improvement.
Yeah. Discontinuous. It's got to get better real quick. Yeah. Yeah. You want to go on with the College Park?
Okay. All right. On this College Park one here. This is definitely the one that we'll be talking a little bit about communications and what we're doing now and the expectations going forward. What we had here is that basically the train was in an outbound move, and we've got a slide a little bit later that will give kind of like a depiction of the overall scene and location. I just would like to point out two areas right in here of this, just of this page here. The time frame of from the 549 to the 614 on our part is of concern that we'll talk about further in the presentation. That length of time, knowing the heat of the day and everything else, the elements and stuff that are out there, is a big concern. We could go to the next slide. Okay, right in here, this is kind of like a continuation of what was taking place from an operator's perspective, also from the transit police. Utilizing their resources as well as, you know, the way that we were working and handling things. A couple of areas that were very critical as we go through this review is passengers exiting, and then also with the working with the transit police whenever they were there to help, you know, manage the process and stuff as well. as we take these things into consideration, it's about time, it's about location, and it's also about the environment and the elements that the customers and the operator and stuff was exposed to at the time of the incident. If we could go to the next slide. Okay, basically this right in here was a six-car train. Gives you an idea of the direction. It was in the direction of Greenbelt. The train itself came to a complete stop. It was about 1,000 feet. So whenever the customers, everybody was departing, and the rescue efforts and stuff, everything was focused, you know, towards the College Park direction. Earlier in the presentation, there was a talk where we had a secondary train that responded, you know, probably in about 10 or 15 minutes to try to come in from behind and to connect and to move forward to move this, you know, move this up. If we could go to the next slide. We know right now that the reason why the train that went down is that we did have a momentary loss of feed, both legs, to the traction power substation. So whenever the operator was operating and going through that area, the electricity was out, okay? A lot of people would say, you know, why didn't we know that? We could go to the next slide. One of the things that took place is due to the weather that we had the previous week, and, you know, we operated and were able to keep this system going, but we had a remote terminal unit that's basically, it's kind of like an overlay, and it tells us if there's actual power and stuff out there that goes back to the control center. The control center was in a dark status. They were not 100% sure. They could not see the actual power grid that was out there. So whenever the other train was dispatched, you know, by process, it was a matter of, okay, we've got a train. It's shut down. We know that we've got customers on it. We've got to try to rescue it. Since that, and for us to offload, for us to approach safely, that's the time, the clock is ticking. The time is ticking very fastly. So whenever that train, the second one, entered in there, then the power was down. So then we lost the second train. Got a little bit better information. The other thing that took place is that on the radio system, the radio system, we are reliant on remote towers throughout the region. Okay, one of the buildings that we were have that one of our towers were mounted on, it lost all of its power, you know, during the course of this regional event with the weather. They had the building powered up, but they did not power up the tower. We did not have the ability to monitor all of our towers remotely to say, is this thing actually online? That's one of the actions that we come out of to say, from a vulnerability standpoint, that we have got to do a much better job. We've got to have some type of intelligence and stuff that's applied there, so that a way we just cannot, you know, we just can't accept that at this stage. Okay, process improvement. One of the things I'd like to stress is that with all of these activities that were taking place, the biggest thing is the heat and the ability for us to know what the status of the equipment was. One of the things that we have great support from Transit Police as we look at this is that we've got support during peak periods, and we have people that are actually there in the control center that are monitoring our AM and our PM. And it's also the way that the railroad has just been managed for many years, is just to say, you know, we've got the support here, you know, this is our typical protocol. Standing back and looking at what's taking place, and this is one of the things that I challenged my staff, is, for example, talking about Dulles Phase 1, Dulles Phase 2, really evaluating the way that we're responding to things, because this is such a vast network of systems, and some of the existing things that have been very successful for many years here and stuff are probably just, you know, they're not as efficient as what they should be. With the operator, for example, with the poor communications that was out there, the operator was required to get out of the rail car. They had to go to the wayside because we have landline phones, you know, ever so many feet, and basically that was the only way that that individual could communicate. Well, we only have one operator. You have hundreds of people on a train, and we're dealing with the weather that's, you know, 90 plus degrees. You know, so the cars without electricity, without climate control and everything else, naturally, that's a big concern on our part. We do not have the ability to monitor what the operator said inside of the rail car. We can, most of the time, we can get what's broadcast on the air. But since we had all these other functions and stuff that were there, we were really, you know, basically, you know, in the dark. I've seen the reports and stuff that's been released about, you know, from the customers and stuff. You know, our operator, she stated, you know, that she did not state that. From my perspective, I'm not here to discredit, because it's an emergency situation. You're dealing with heat. You're dealing with hundreds of people. You know, our staff is moving one rail car more than what a 747 is. And it's one person trying to help hundreds. So what do we do to change this moving forward? So during this, especially during the summer months, but we'll apply this even larger, within the first 5 minutes of any incident, instead of kind of waiting and stuff for that recovery, we've worked with the transit police, with our power folks, with emergency management and stuff. If we don't get a few areas of, say, for instance, do you have climate control? Do you have lighting? Or if that operator, say, for instance, has to step off, we have got to start mobilizing our resources right then and there, because it's going to take 10 minutes or 20 minutes or so to go. Not that it'll make things perfect or whatever, because we don't have staff in every location, but it's something that I've applied at another agency that I worked at, because people would go real fast. And whenever you have the weather and stuff of that, it's the clock, like I said, is ticking. I think the other thing that's also very important to understand is that the philosophy of the control center and of the rail transportation is that this has to be applied in a 24/7 environment, because transit police doesn't have the resources to be with us 24/7, you know, and their emergency manager. It's just not at that level. But we do know that we have staff in the field. We do know that we have other resources and stuff that are around there. And our priority, whenever a rail car, you know, does go down in this type of an environment, it was no different when the night of whenever we had the weather move in, all resources around one rail car, making sure that that power was either restored or we were going to evacuate them. So we need to do that on a regular basis across the board. Now, there's just concerns to say, well, you're going to react, you know, and you're going to fatigue, you know, some of your folks, or you're going to ramp up. But we're dealing with hundreds of people. We're dealing with thousands of people within this rail system, and I think it's very prudent for us to take it to the next level as we look at this. I think the other component of this, looking at it, is from a communications perspective. The days of doing good train announcements and good station announcements, it's not acceptable anymore. It doesn't really apply. I mean, that's just one part of it. We really have to look at from a standard of, what are we communicating at the scene locally? How are we communicating with our emergency management partners, transit police, fire department? What are we communicating internally as we deploy these resources? What are we communicating globally on the rail system? What are we communicating globally at the specific stations that are the area that's impacted? As well as, what are we communicating through our bus operations control center? Because this system, our systems, are about a point A to point B journey. And we have to be able to cover every one of those functions, and it's going to be difficult. But we have to have that attentiveness of how we are communicating during, before, and after. And especially even after we stabilize it, there has to be a better focus of getting folks where they need to be to clarify that. So that's a big initiative on my part. I know that we'll be working with Lynn. You know, it's stuff that I've already been reaching out with my staff, because when we really think about it, in the next few years, we're going to be all the way at Wheelie Avenue and from New Carrollton. And you think of all of the people that are captured in this system that are backed up, or what we're seeing on the red line. So we really have to approach it in a much different perspective and a much different venue. And that's some of the things, for example, we might be taking advantage of these new business tools on evaluation for us to be successful for resources, you know, of that. But for us to be successful, you know, from that perspective, that's the drive and that's the pursuit in which we're undertaking. So I'm open for questions on this one. Sorry I went long.
Question. Mr. Yule.
Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. The question I have is, for our stations and other parts of the system, do we not have backup generators?
No. Some stations do, some stations don't. We really rely on, a lot of times, backfeeding throughout. The way that this system was designed was its first stage primary is power to the rail cars to keep things going. The secondary side of this is power at stations.
So, I mean, we don't, but is there a view to consider?
Yes, actually, some of the things that we've done, for example, is that through y'all's support, we've bought portable generators. Where it's not practical for me to maybe go down 100 feet and put a generator and stuff in, or I have issues with local jurisdictions because they don't like generators installed, we've actually went through the initiative where we're able to pull in a large unit, mobilize it, we have connections and everything else, and we're able to power up the station, you know, accordingly. But it's that point in time of the station is dark to whenever we get it reestablished that is very, very critical. We kind of got the back end of it towards where, you know, where we know that we can kind of sustain it and handle it, but it's the minutes between out to restore that we really need to constantly, you know, squeeze in on.
Thank you for that presentation. I think it was extremely helpful, and I'm very pleased at the things that you've been considering and thinking about since it happened. In many ways, I'm more concerned about this than I am about the previous one that you talked about. I think we have good capacity to deal with engineering problems, which is what I think the derailment and the heat kinks are. I'm not sure that we are as advanced in terms of dealing with communications and human reaction problems. And I think that the things that you've started talking about are excellent ways to approach it. I guess I would ask for a couple of other things that you might want to look at. One would be, it seems that one of the things that went wrong in this particular situation was we were putting an awful lot of burden on the train operator to both assess the situation, deal with the situation, and communicate about the situation. That may be something that we should stop thinking we can rely on a single train operator to do and come up with better ways of communicating with passengers that don't rely on this person who's responsible for all those other things and running the train to be the primary communications avenue. From what I read, it seems that a lot of the passengers took their own initiative to establish other means of communication, you know, calling WMATA, doing other things. And we need to perhaps think of creating some of those channels ourselves. I mean, we are doing much better than we used to by putting information out on Twitter and things like that, and we need to figure out a way to communicate those, to incorporate those avenues into sort of emergency communications. And the other thing is, I think we need to look at this incident and, as was mentioned earlier, sort of dissect it, analyze it, and figure out systematically some things that we could do beyond communications that might be helpful. Training people, education of passengers on hazards is all very well and good, but we know that in the future we will have incidents that will cause passengers to be concerned, and giving them information goes only so far. You need to also address other kinds of concerns that they might have. And I think you've identified communications as being one of the big ones. But, you know, sitting in a hot car for a prolonged period of time, I'm sure if you talk to Pepco about the responses they got to people sitting in hot houses for several days, that people stop reacting rationally to things. And so I really think we've got to go beyond sort of dealing with this as if this is an information and rationality issue, and start looking at some of those other issues,
yeah,
too.
I'll comment on that. I think one of the key things here, which Dave mentioned, was that besides the operator having a number of things to do, having to get off the train, we didn't, and the previous protocol was once you determine that power is down, then you send in people to help rescue, get people off the train. The change in protocol after that incident is that we no longer wait to hear whether power is down. If we don't in an affirmative response that power is up, and therefore the people are in comfortable conditions, in the first 5 minutes, people go. Because what we found, you know, not only in sense here, elsewhere, is the best thing is to have other people there on the train, you know, from us or the fire department, that can tell people what's going on, we're going to get you off, and frankly a sense of comfort that there are people handling them. So that's one of the key changes Dave has made, is now within approximately 5 minutes, if we don't know that power's up, the police are heading in that direction, the fire department's heading that direction. That's one of the differing things between this incident and the derailment incident. And that derailment incident, which was a couple days later, we knew power was down instantly, and people were on their way, and they got onto that train, and they were dealing with people much sooner. That has always been, you know, it's even, not only when we talk about on the train itself, but back in the stations, people's presence is what makes a difference, and that's one of the key changes Dave has made here.
And if I could, just also from a maintenance perspective, we've got all this nice technology, remote terminal units, we're looking at this. But at the end of the day, we were dark. So that's the other thing, the protocol, is that we will put a crew into that train control room, into the traction power room, and they will be there. I mean, because it's not that we have a lot of these issues that are down, but whenever we notice something that is out of the ordinary, maybe it was acceptable, you know, several years ago whenever we were just running 2- and 4-car trains, but now this system is just, you know, reaching its capacity, and it's the expectation of the maintenance staff, the transportation staff, what we can do operationally, because, like I say, you know, the transit police are doing a great job, safety's doing a great job, but collectively there's some other things that we can work to constantly improve and just react. And also we're looking forward to deploying some of these things as we look forward. Not that we don't want any incidents, but, you know, you really judge on how you manage yourself through them.
If I could just follow up, I think I would agree with you, and I think the additional communications and the faster reactions, both of which sound like you're, that's the right thing, the right way to be going.
Thank you, Mr. Dent. I mean, let me just make one comment. Years ago, the thought was the only way to get information to the customer is through the train operator. Today, every customer is out there with something that they could get their own communication. We probably want to think about how to use that channel.
The thing that struck me the most was not knowing for certain whether or not part of the network was, or part of our system was dark. That's a system capacity that somehow needs to be addressed, and not knowing that the tower on the communications block was not reset when the power came back is another it needs to be part of a regular network of information that you can depend on, because it's very hard to act on information you don't have. And I know that's expensive probably, but in terms of long-term reliability and actionable help that the authority can provide, that kind of information is paramount.
Those efforts are underway, like we showed in the control center. Elevator, escalator, we've got monitoring, we're coming online. Radio communication, CCTV, is the next phase where we're looking at networking all of these systems, because the technology can work very well for us as our resources are thin. At least we kind of have a pinpoint idea, and then if we do see a known defect, then we should react, you know, accordingly. So that effort is underway.
Thank you. I had a couple other things to.
Yes, sir.
Friction.
I guess I'll set these up here for those who can't see this. Since these have been underneath discussion for a bit, I figured we'd bring this in so we could start clarifying a little bit of our configurations. We can go to the next slide, please. Okay, Minnesota Avenue. This right in here is a 5,000 series type friction ring, 5 and 6. Now, if you notice, if you take a look at this thing in here and you look at it up there with the picture and stuff, this is not a small piece of equipment, okay? What we found here on this incident here is that basically the bolts, this is the hardware that we utilize. These washers they work off of a compression fit. I can pass these around if you're interested. They've got holes and stuff in them for them to be safety wired. Basically, then also the gradient of the bolt is also very important. When you look at these three bolts and stuff right here, they look exactly the same. Those are from three different suppliers. One of the things that we've always talked about is the configuration control and making sure that we're able to use the right hardware and to document these things. On this particular incident right in here, we had a problem where all of the bolts came out. It wasn't a matter of them being broken, but they were not secured properly. If we could go to the next slide. Whenever we looked at this scenario here, when we talk about these bolts, there's a process of where you install them in dry, where you don't use any type of lubricant or anything else. Or if you do put lubricant on them, that changes the torque value whenever you tighten these things down. But one of the things as we look at this, we are a 9-yard facility with 7 maintenance shops. We have thousands of people that are working on these things, and whenever they're reacting and handling these materials and these parts. Whenever we went back and we basically just went through down to the level of going to the shop and the shift to start putting this thing back together to see where was the failure point of what was taking place. We had some measures that were in place like our torque procedures and everything else as far as the equipment stuff that was correct. But we did find out that we have different shifts, different people applying these things a little bit differently. One of the things that's also a concern of this is even the wire, which seems to be very rudimentary. Whenever we went and started looking at this, some of the wire that was being procured is too soft. So even if everything's put in place and stuff, the wire and stuff is too soft. This is a very, very important feature because on these type of builds and this type of area right in here, even after it's torqued using these special washers and everything else, they are tied off like military grade type, tie off points. Working with the safety department, we brought in LTK. They do a great job. We've worked with our internal staff engineering and stuff. And I'm really trying to. Staff is directed to approach this whenever I first got here, dealing with these NTSB recommendations on wheel trim. We went in and we just stepped back and we re-baselined everything. We brought in the field, and far too often what happens is the decisions are made at such a high level that the frontline people that are doing the work are not brought into it. So the frontline folks that are doing this work are part of this process where we're going to go through here, look at the way that we're torquing these things, look at the way that we're handling these things. We will go through every car that we have will be disassembled and taken down. We are not going to take a chance of having, we think that it's okay just by a sampling effort. That will take several months. I wanted to show this, if we could go to the next slide. There's been a lot of discussions whenever we had the failures of the 2-3K. This flange and this friction ring are all one part, okay? They are cast together. They are one chunk. This is the 5000 series friction ring that you see. This is the component right in here. So whenever we showed y'all pictures in some of our other presentations where this was snapping right here in this area, it gives you an idea in magnitude of how robust this piece of equipment and stuff is. It also ties back into the geometry vehicle. It also ties back into us checking the infrastructure. The lateral load, the G-force that these things see is significant. And so we have naturally no margin of error for these things here. Next slide, please. Okay, I kind of jumped ahead on this as far as, process, improvement. It's a matter of June, we just deployed our new Maximo part of our ongoing capital. We now can lock down what bolt is being bought, working with procurement, working through engineering, working through quality, and our staff. It's something that the features that we didn't really have. You could verbalize it, but now we have a systematic approach to start working this. This is working with the tools that y'all are providing us, which are, it's very, very key. We're going to go back and talk with some of our installation processes and making sure that we are torquing them right, making sure that we cross-hatch everything properly. What that is basically you just don't bolt it up on one side because you're holding all this weight. You have to kind of do a cross pattern to make sure that everything pulls up and secures itself properly. So we're going down to this level of detail very systematically. Further develop quality control inspections. A lot of times we talk a lot about preventative maintenance. Well, this type of work could happen in unscheduled maintenance. It could happen in a overhaul environment. It could happen on brand new equipment. So one of the things that we're also looking at is expanding the sampling. It's not just about the preventative maintenance. We've got to look at these other functions in which we know that these things, you know, might be handled. If we could go back to the other slide, wanted to talk about the Rhode Island incident that we had on the 19th, I think it was. What we had here, we had an ALP disc, which is a little bit different disc. It's really along the lines of the 2-3K. And this one right in here, this is just a generic disc, but the new one, we had some bolts and stuff that actually broke. When we went back through to look at this, what we found out is that this friction ring, or it's not this particular one, I'm sorry, but the friction ring that was on the car was installed since 2009. It was part of the original test. When we went back through this systematically, we found out that the bolts through the progression of the test were not upgraded to the final configuration. So the bolts fatigued. We have new bolts and everything. We know where we're going. We were also very pleased because the friction ring, to get that level of service life, is very, very good, because beforehand what we were seeing with some of the others, we were done in a couple of years. And so we still have good quality, you know, service life for us to continue the braking application, which over the long term saves us money and time, you know, as far as quality of materials. So I did want to kind of show you about the hub, and also hopefully this will be a little bit more helpful just to kind of give you an idea of the difference of the applications. People ask me how much these things weigh. Think collectively, maybe use a range between about 130 and 140 pounds a piece. So it is some very robust equipment, and that's why we have to be very sensitive. And one of the things, for example, even on this hardware, is the way that it's machined. If it's cut really sharp and the technicians try to tighten the wire around it, the force that they're applying, it'll cut the wire. So one of these boats, I won't tell you which one, is actually the correct one. And it's chamfered the way that it should be. And then the others, we're looking at that across the board. And so we do think that we've got a good handle on this, but we're, like I said, our testing is ongoing. We go into our next phase of mainline testing this July, and we expect to have some reports and stuff later on in the year for us to really start looking at this lateral load testing and stuff as it applies to these parts. That concludes the presentation on this one here.
Yes, question, Tom?
Since the 5K is always in trouble, you know, our bad cars, what's the new car is going to have for this kind of stuff that we're getting from Japan? Are we getting away from this?
I would say probably the first thing right off the bat is that the truck design, the actual design, the way it's fabricated, we will not even use that design. We're going with a new suspension, a new fabrication. It's a totally different application. Kawasaki. They've made a lot of trucks over the decades. They know their business. We don't need to tell them how to build a truck. We know that their truck will work. And so that's the first thing that will take place. The new hubs that we have installed with the new loads and stuff, working with Knorr, it's a global company. They make some of the best brake products around. You know, they're confident. They've supported us accordingly. But that's why we're also taking it to the next level, as we communicated to y'all beforehand. We just can't go off of what the engineering or consultant or whatever tells us. It's our railroad. We've got to take it to the next level as we utilize it in this area.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anything else?
Next. Yeah. Okay. Trying to do our best. Sorry it's so long. Okay, red signal violations. Had a question on this here. This kind of gives you an idea of what a red signal looks like underground. We had two incidents. Some interesting things, some commonalities as we go through this. Eight-car trains up at Grosvenor. Basically what happened is that this is happening, or both of these incidents happened during peak revenue service whenever the trains were being offloaded.
Right?
Pardon?
This is a scheduled turnback.
Scheduled turnbacks, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And so basically what we had here was that, the operator was eight-car train, offloaded at Grosvenor the way that they should, pulled into the pocket track, and then basically ran the red signal. I point out the time frames of these. You're going to see that they're about the same, a little over an hour or so. The reason why that these things are going to take this length of time, as we get to another diagram, when you have a violation with switches and with other hardware and everything else, we want to make sure that we go back through and inspect everything the way that we need to. You keep stuff in place so that way we can investigate it. I don't want to have a switch that we think that, oh, we'll just go ahead and run through it, because if not, then we could definitely have other issues down the road. So this is by design on the side of caution and of safety. Again, the biggest thing is not to run them. Next slide. Okay. Kind of the same time frame, same length of time and stuff that's associated with it. Eight-car train. And, single tracking efforts and stuff take care, occur through this. We can go to the next slide. This is Grosvenor over here to the right. Sorry, it didn't show up too good. Grosvenor Station, this top track is the outbound track going to Shady Grove. Naturally, this is the one that's going in. This gives you an idea of the amount of signals that are, these red are every signal that is underground. So when the operator offloads right here in this at the station, they have to go here, switch at signal 42 through 40. Then they have to pull this thing all the way down here to signal 34. Now, one of the things with an eight-car train, this area right in here is only about 670 feet. An eight-car train is 600 feet. So when you have an operator that's being asked to make a diverging move, another move, pull in here and stop with peak service, three minutes, they have to be pinpoint accurate. If they stop short, for example, we will pretty much, the train control system will pick it up, and it won't even allow movement stuff to go forward. So this is a very tight-knit area with a lot of duty cycle that's taking place. And so the other thing is, it's also safe to assume, is that we'll have rail cars coming from Shady Grove down. This car will be staged right in here. Once this one passes, we'll have one follow right behind it, or it could be a leading move as well. So you have this parallel activity. It's the same thing that's kind of happening on the Silver Spring side, but the big difference here is this is all below ground and very tight quarters. Next slide, please. Okay, again, both incidents related to eight-car trains. One of the things that we looked at in here is that the newer operators, or maybe they were new to the alignment. We had somebody who just came out of class that hadn't been in there very long. And then the other component of this one is due to the shift pick. The person came over. They're certified, but the familiarity and to hit the marks perfectly every time is something that we have to review. I mean, bottom line is we have a red signal out there. It's just like a stoplight. You shouldn't go past it. But for whatever reason, it occurred. Next slide, please.
And when it occurs, it's going to be a lengthy shutdown.
Yes, yes.
Recovery.
So actions as taken by management at this stage. Again, we reinforce our existing rules. The rules are similar to what all railroads use throughout, so there's a communication on that. We'll talk about this communication to the operator a little bit more in another slide. Increased quality control checks. One of the things that we're also asking staff to do is that whenever we know that we have a class that just graduates, we've been kind of focused in trying to do the mentoring, talking with them in the yards and in stations and, kind of off to the side. But we probably need to do a little bit better job of being out in the field and stuff with them. So if we know that we've got some vulnerable areas and stuff, having somebody down there in the track bit in a safe position, but for them to see somebody physically there, knowing that we're monitoring and stuff of what's taking place, could be very, very important. And we could do this on a random basis. So those are some initiatives that we're looking at. The other thing that we took advantage of is like our local safety committees. One of the things that we're looking at is we have this incident. We had these incidents. Take the information. It's already being talked about by the employees and everything else. We need to take advantage of that and communicate our concerns, what we're finding, what we're seeing. It's another venue, just that constant reminder to say, you know, be very wary of your environment. The other thing is that like rail transportation, they have their own newsletter that comes out of the managing director's office. He puts references and stuff of that. So it's not just a management perspective, but we're also trying to take advantage of some other venues that's at our disposal. We can go to the next slide. Okay, engineering analyzed an interlocking panel at Grosvenor at the blockhouse. Back in the 1990s, I guess there was a decision that they were going to eliminate Grosvenor, was at least what I was told, what we've seen. They're going to run everything to Shady Grove. There was a lot of discussions. I see some people smiling, so I might need to talk with you to get educated on this. Well, what happened was that they took out some technology where we have these turnback areas where we had an actual interlocking panel where we have staff staged. They could actually see what's taking place. So what we plan on doing, because we know that this interlocking, we're going to treat it's going to be here for a long time, we're going to go back and reinstall the technology that others that took out for whatever reason. It's just another venue. So that way the interlocking operator, you know, has access. So it's not only just the ability for that person to see the train approaching, communicating with the other operators and stuff that's working there, but it's also if they walk in, they know the status of what's taking place of all of those switches and stuff that I told you. It could also be, even though we get all these alarms and everything else, it's nice to have that redundancy of what the control center is seeing and the interlocking person might be seeing and also what's being communicated to maintenance. It helps validate and create more precise and exact information whenever we're trying to work through these. Again, we can't have folks, you know, running the red signals, and that's where we'll, you know, continue to work and talk with them. But whenever we open up Dulles Phase 1, when we're going into the stadium armor area, you know, there's going to be a big turn back. So we're really trying, not only is it just about this area right in here, but whenever we get over there, what can we do to try to prevent this as much as possible? It's just what's going to be happening, what's going to be asked of this railroad. So I think that's it. That concludes the presentation on this. I'm open for any questions.
Any further questions? And the thing I'm happy to hear is process improvement, learn, figure out what we can do to minimize things, but also understand them better. Yes.
In that regard, Dave, and this may be also for the general manager, Jim Dyke and I are on a board of another organization that has occasional safety issues and injuries of personnel and whatnot, and they have a process that they've had in place for a number of years now. It seemed to me to make a lot of sense, and Jim and I talked about it. Whenever an employee is injured or if there's some kind of safety issue, they have a senior management committee that meets with that employee, not in a, you know, blame kind of thing, yeah. But how can we avoid this? How can we make sure this doesn't happen again? But it's a very senior management committee. Yeah. It's, you know, it's you that's part of that. And employees don't want to be back, don't want to have to do that again. Yeah. And they really feel that has helped to reduce employee injuries. Even if it's a minor one, you know, somebody sprains their ankle, they have to come in and meet with that committee and say, how could we make sure other employees don't sprain their ankle the way I did when I was doing that particular process in my job? Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's just something that we've seen in another organization that seems to have had some effect in reducing safety issues, and maybe it's something for management to consider here.
I can talk to what I have implemented on these accidents, and I've seen it a lot on the wayside on whenever we've had other equipment issues. And I always view that a lot of times whenever we have an accident or failure, it's really never single point. There's really, you know, several circumstances that, you know, lead up to it. So I call it the layers of three, or that's what my staff tells me it is, layers of three. So, for example, on these right in here, whenever we have an operator that runs a red signal, naturally, you know, they're going to be interviewed by the supervisor, you know, the direct people, and then they're going to go get tested. But now the requirement is that the line superintendent of that division has to conduct an interview, the overall line director that manages all the lines, and then the managing director of rail transportation. They are all involved in that very, maybe a little bit different process than what you're talking about. But while this employee has went out and is getting tested, they still work for us. They're with us. You know, we need to see what's taking place. And so we're bringing these people right back into the office to see, you know, what's taking place. And I kind of separated it a little bit because I wanted to kind of see how the reports come back from the interviewing. Is my superintendent doing a good enough job of reporting information? What is this? What are they comfortable saying to one person, you know, versus the other? Because at the end of the day, we just don't want any red signal violations. We really don't want that. And so that's what we've undertaken, you know, at least at this stage. But I'd be interested to communicate a little bit more off to the side on what y'all are doing. Okay.